Welcome to Roundtables on Race, the podcast that seeks to explore the relationship between race and the many facets of our society. I'm your host, the Reverend Kathy Walker, and we are glad to have you with us for our third season. This season is an exploration of the intersection of race and education and the many facets of this highly charged topic. One of the ongoing arguments around race and education is about teaching of race and racism. They're often used as interchangeable terms in the course of conversation. So today, we want to look at the difference between the terms and what we're really talking about when these terms are used in relation to education. And to help us do that, we are joined today by two guests whose expertise in this area runs deep and just last year culminated in a partnership that produced their book, Racism, Not Race, Answers to Frequently Asked Questions. We welcome to the podcast Dr. Joseph Graves and Dr. Alan Goodman. Dr. Joseph Graves is a professor in the Department of Biology at North Carolina A&T State University. He is a fellow of the Council of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. In addition to his book, Racism, Not Race, he is the author of The Emperor's New Clothes, Biological Theories of Race at the Millennium, and The Race Myth, Why We Pretend Race Exists in America. Dr. Alan Goodman is a professor of biological anthropology at Hampshire College and a former vice president of academic affairs. He is a past president of the American Anthropological Association and co-directs its public education project on race. In addition to Racism, Not Race, he is a co-author of Race, Are We So Different? And several other books. Welcome to Dr. Graves and Dr. Goodman. Hello.
Thank you for having us today, Kathy.
It's great to have you here. So I want to tell you a little bit about this book from my perception, and then I'm going to ask a couple of questions, because I absolutely have enjoyed reading this book. And that was very surprising to me. First of all, because it's written by two scientists, so I expected something so in the weeds. And I am great at writing a sentence, but the term science is almost really scary to me. So the idea that I was going to have to really dig deep into biology or something like that and kind of go into the recesses of my brain was really chilling. But this book is written in such a plainspoken view that any of us could read it, understand it, and enjoy it and learn from it. So having said that, and I'm not saying that just because you're my guest, but it really is a wonderful read, and it's a great topic for us to get into. So I want to start with defining the terms. What is the difference between race and racism? Should I start with Joe on this one?
Yeah, sure. Because, you know, Alan and I have done podcasts together before, and usually the questions are such that either one of us could answer. So we usually look to each other for nods about who should go. So I'll go with race, and then Alan, you can finish up with racism.
Sounds great.
So the idea of race exists in both the biological sciences as well as the social sciences and the humanities. And those definitions are very, very different in those different disciplines. So I'm going to talk about how race is understood in modern biology. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about how it was understood in the biology that was in operation at the time the concept really came into the Western world. Okay. So let's start with what we know today. Okay. So when we talk about a biological race, it is a subdivision within a species of organisms. It can be defined by a set of criteria. Those criteria include the amount of genetic variation within various groups in that species versus the genetic variation between the groups in that species. And those things can be measured, particularly now with modern sequencing technology. You know, we've learned a great deal about what variation looks like in a number of species, including humans, but a whole bunch of other species. Another way that you can define a race in modern biology has to do with whether any group within that species can be considered an evolutionarily distinct lineage, meaning that the amount of gene flow between that group and the rest of the species is very, very, very low. Now, that's the way we view it in the biology of the late 20th century and 21st century. However, when the concept worked its way into the natural science of the Western world, that was really in the 17th century. And their views about what a biological race should be had to do with the relationship between their science and their theology. And at that time, there was really no difference between them. So the people who were studying these questions would have considered themselves natural theologists, attempting to understand God's creation through the works of nature. And for those folks, they described subdivisions or varieties in the human species based upon what individuals look like and how they thought they behaved. In the 19th century, it also moved into a question of whether different groups of human beings were the acts of separate special creations from God. And that was called the pre-Adamite race theory or polygenism. And particularly this idea was popular with slaveholders because it essentially held that different so-called races of human beings had been the act of different creations that were distinctly inferior to the progeny of Adam and Eve, which of course were Europeans. The other people on the earth, particularly the darker skinned people, were the product of what they call the pre-Adamite races. And so this biological race concept begins in theology. And that theology also informed the way that it worked its way into the anthropology and natural science of the 19th century. So, Alan.
Yeah. So the question of what is racism has been one that's been kind of vexing to a lot of people about, you know, where does, for example, prejudice or ethnocentrism end and racism begins, or how do such things become racisms? And an old formulation that I still like a lot is that racism is prejudice plus power. That one can, you know, discriminate against a group, can be prejudiced against a group, but can't really impact that group in a real tangible, you know, detrimental way unless there's a power differential. I mean, it's possible that, you know, prejudice hurts, but racism hurts a lot more. So that's one way to think about that. Of course, as Joe said, if groups have to be culturally defined, not genetically or biologically defined. A little bit of the problem of that definition, or a way to, I think about it, improve it, problematize it a little bit, is that it's a little bit individualized. So that's thinking about individuals, perhaps, or we think about individuals as having power. And it's not really individuals that have power, but it's groups, it's institutions. And a lot of power comes out of structures. And so those structures that are built, you know, become structural racisms. And I think it's those things much more than individual racisms that have consequences today. So how does, say, racisms in the past have impact today? And I think that's really an important question, is not just what racism is, but what is the impact of racism? What's the consequence of racism? Well, past racisms can get embodied, and past racisms can lead to wealth inequalities, and those wealth inequalities carry through to today. So, you know, so one way to think about it is that, you know, there's personal racisms or individual racisms, which people have in their minds, that intersects with cultural racisms, with structural racisms, with systemic racisms. And I think it's really one of the things we ought to be trying to do is shift the locus of focus from I'm not racist as an individual to understanding how I contribute to a racial structure that in fact has differential impacts on different groups.
So I really love that definition of racism, really kind of the prejudice plus power, because automatically that means, I guess, that oppressed people cannot be prejudiced. So I did like the distinction then that you made between bigotry and racism. And can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the questions we had in the book, and I'm happy, you know, Reverend Walker, that you like the Q&A format of the book. But one of the questions I was most happy to jump on is the question of reverse racism. And, you know, and to say that's not a thing. Reverse racism is not a thing for exactly the reasons you cite, is that there's not without a reversal of power, you can't have reverse racism. You can have plenty of prejudice and bias and whatever, but you're not going to have racism. And most importantly, you're not going to have the incredible consequences of racism and differences in wealth and health and other matters of life, almost every other matter of life.
So, Joe, that brings me to ask you, even if we could get rid of this man-made construct of race, would it in any way impact the course of racism? Or do we have to dismantle them both or separately?
But, you know, to answer your question, you know, Reverend Kathy, racism is what created the concept of race, meaning social definitions that we live under today. It was the process of, you know, colonialism and enslaving large numbers of people that required a system of classification which related those people to the power structure within that society and who was capable of having rights and who was not capable of having rights in those racially stratified societies. Now, having said that, one of the reasons we wrote Racism, Not Race was to dispel the idea that humans had biological divisions that could be called racist, because most of racist policy and practice relies upon the idea that there are these innate, genetically determined differences between groups of people, which then justify the differential treatment of those people. So, for example, you know, Blacks are not as intelligent as whites, or Blacks are not as energetic socially as whites, or, you know, Blacks have shiftless personalities compared to whites. All of those things reside in the notion that there's these innate genetically determined differences between groups of people. So when you pull that prop out under, you know, racist ideology, then those folks have to explain the injustices and the disparities that exist within our society as the result of the actions of social structures, as opposed to innate characteristics of people. So, yes, we must first dispel the notion of biological race within humans. Certainly, as we show in the book, there is genetic variation that is associated with geographic population structure. None of that rises to the level of allowing us to say that these groups are really, discrete racial entities. And when you pull that prop out, those who, you know, support these racist notions and justify them, they're really in a difficult place intellectually, because their main argument is that this is an innate difference. And I will say this, because, you know, this is going out to a lot of Episcopalians. Remember, as I said in my first response, for most of the time that Western society existed, this innateness was justified within religious theological belief. And people thought that persons of European descent had been ordained had been given a manifest destiny to control the world in God's name over these, you know, godless, you know, savages that they were coming in contact with, who were inferior for either the reason of degeneration or being created separately. So when we pull this innateness out, then folks have got to explain, they've got to come up with reasons for why these disparities exist, and they can't do it. And they're forced to admit that this is because of their societal structures and practice.
Sure. And I think a lot of what you saw was a time when you had missionaries going all around the world, and it was to try to save the savages, right? That was sort of the concept, that if they could introduce them to God and Christianity in particular, they would be able to turn them into in a different way and make them something that they sadly were not.
I think this is such an important sort of area to think about, especially in light of, you know, the topic for this season of education. And, you know, that because this is a topic for which you need to understand the science, as Joe's laying out, and as well a lot of really interesting history, and kind of a little bit about how societies structure themselves and how societies interact. But I want to say a little bit more about, you know, kind of what Joe's saying about the relationship between race and racism. And for the most part, we've thought about racism as something happening from race, that racism is the child of the father or mother of race. And what Joe's saying, which you could see them interacting or being dialectical, but I think what Joe is really saying that I think makes a lot of sense when you look at history is that kind of racism came first, and we had to invent the idea of race to justify the racism of the time, of colonialism, of slavery, my God. And so, in fact, if you imagine yourself living in the state of Virginia in the 1650s and you're an English settler, you're lucky enough to be an English settler, not an indentured Irishman or an enslaved African, you have to invent, conveniently, the idea of race to try to separate out those indentured Europeans, indentured Irish, from the Africans. So how do you do it? You come up, you're practicing racism and discrimination, and so you have to make up stories about Africans as, you know, being less than, and in all of these ways that Joe has mentioned and unfortunately are still a part of the American ideological ideas, which we haven't mentioned, about ideological racism. And that, I think, is what Joe and I have really tried to get at, is that there's an underlying ideology of separate and unequal, and that's racism too.
Exactly. And I think, you know, so I was thinking when I initially started to read your book, of the contrast between yours and Isabel Wilkerson's cast, right? So could we just trade one thing for another? So, you know, we would move, let's say, we would maybe want to salute ourselves and pat ourselves on the back if we could figure out a way to eradicate racism. And then there would be like this still social order in place. Like, is there something in human beings that needs to have some sort of a system where we figure out one group is better than another?
I would say absolutely not.
Not. Okay.
Not. Because remember, the first human beings were communal groups. Mm-hmm. And, you know, during our hunter-gatherer phase, we didn't have strong social hierarchy of the kind which appeared after the production of agriculture and the development of cities. So we didn't have to be. And you know, in my biopic, Voice in the Wilderness, I talk about how human brains evolved to be cooperative. So the notion that human beings are intrinsically evil biologically is just wrong. You know, we respond to the social conditions in which we are living. And if we have incentives for pro-social behavior, then people will be more pro-social. But if we live in a society that justifies competition and exploitation of other people, and you know, glorifies that, and again, for those of us who listening, who are Christians, who see those things as idols, I mean, that's not what we are called to do by our faith. Okay, that's clearly idolatry. So we do not have to be competitive. We don't have to be mean-spirited. In fact, our scriptures call us to be the exact opposite of those things. But unfortunately, and then I will say this, and I will not say it with any sort of apology, right now, okay, white evangelical Christians are the biggest impediment to social justice in the United States. And there's a great deal of sociological evidence that supports that. And so one of the reasons, again, why we wrote this book was to take away those props of biological innateness and help people understand the way structural racism was woven into the fabric of American society by people who proclaimed to be Christian.
Yeah, I think I want to just say, I think Joe makes a super important point, and also I'm happy you brought Isabel Wilkerson into this discussion because I think it intersects nicely with what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And just to reinforce what Joe is saying, as an anthropologist who really works on these sorts of things, 99% of human history, we didn't have hierarchies. And that, developed with agriculture, and it's gotten more and more so. So we live in a society that's incredibly unequal. And what Wilkerson tries to say is that that has a consequence for everybody. That's really important. I think that one of the things we need to do is understand that there's not a, it's not race or class, for example. We can't say, well, if we don't have racism, we're going to have classism. It's not one or the other, but both are equally harmful, and they, in fact, do intersect.
Mm. So now I want to ask you, because one of the things in the book that you mentioned is about Robin DiAngelo and her thesis of white fragility. And so and that brought me to thinking about institutional racism. And is that anything? First, you can tell me what is white fragility? And then I guess the second part of that question is, can we ever deconstruct institutional racism if we have to be concerned about fragility on either part, right? On either, for either of the races?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start with that, Joe, if you want.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
White fragility, I think, and I think this notion is important. Some people feel like it's a little bit overblown, but I think it is an important notion about the fear of white folk to talk about race, and especially to talk about racism. That's one of the things I think Joe and I are trying to do, is subtly shift the discussion from not just talking about difference in race, but really about the process, about racism, about what the ideology of race does. I think a lot of white folk are afraid of, and we've seen this in a lot of the anti-race legislation coming forth, that this fear of, oh my God, if we talk about race or we talk about the history of racism, that it's going to, white folk are going to get uncomfortable. And I think she's just saying we need to be a little bit less fragile, a little bit less fearful that we're going to hear something about bad about our ancestors or about our current behaviors or current institutions. And yeah, and I think that that's, you know, I think an important contribution to really understanding that. And we, unfortunately, in the last few years, I think we've seen a rising up of white fragility, you know, by legislatures and by, you know, educational groups and all that stuff, saying we can't teach this book because, you know, our poor sons and daughters are, you know, it's going to make them feel bad, in quotes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is really one of these red herring arguments, this whole notion that teaching, you know, what actually happened in American history is going to make, you know, some students feel uncomfortable. One of the things that leads to learning is to become uncomfortable with revealed knowledge. One of the core attributes of a critical thinker is not to ever become comfortable with the knowledge they think they know, to question its foundations, to question its assumptions, to require standards of logic and evidence before accepting anything. Now, the way the curriculum has been taught specifically around race, and in fact, I've written a number of essays going back 20 years ago. You know, the first one was called Why We Should Teach Our Students About Race, because in fact, in America's K-12 system, we do not teach the material that Alan and I wrote in this book. In fact, I'm literally right before I got on this podcast, I was running an institute for K-12 teachers to learn new biotechnology methods to include in their curriculum in North Carolina. And we talked about how do we talk about human biological variation, because those teachers had never been taught the material so that they would be able to effectively address it in the curriculum. And the reason they have never been taught is because, one, to teach about human biological variation correctly, you have to be able to teach evolution. Now, former Confederate states get D's through F when it comes to their biology curriculum regarding evolution in general, and particularly human evolution. And the second point, of course, is if you start teaching about race and racism, then students are going to ask uncomfortable questions about the injustices that they can clearly see in their society. So people like DeSantis in Florida and our own legislature here in North Carolina, what they are trying to head off is social movements for justice. Because if, you know, you can't name the issue, right, then there's no discussion, there's no thinking. And that's what these folks want. They want a compliant, docile group of people that they can tell what to do. They don't want kids coming up and thinking about the society they live in and wanting to make it better and wanting to address the things that they can clearly see with their own two eyes.
You know, the enigma of that, though, is that in this day and age, you think of social media and so many ways in which kids and adults alike can gather information. I mean, isn't that kind of a fool's errand? Or, I mean, it may set us back temporarily, but really, can they expect that young people will never learn history or the truth about themselves or their ancestors? Alan, you may want to weigh in on that one.
You know, I fear, you know, that we live in such informational silos today that it may in fact be possible, or, you know, that you take, I think, you know, Joe's talked about critical thinking, and critical thinking is not necessarily believing everything you're exposed to. Critical thinking is really trying to evaluate information and getting access to high quality information, not tweets and things of that sort, without reference and et cetera. So that's why, for example, I think Joe was very clear in this book that we're going to have the primary sources in this book. We're going to have a long set of references in bibliography. And if folks don't quite understand or believe what we say, they can go dip into the historical literature or the scientific literature and things of that sort. Kathy, I wish I could be more optimistic, but I think right now we're at a place where I think even though we have access to a lot of information, the quality, average quality of the information is going down. Critical thinking, I think, is probably going down as well. Interdisciplinary projects are going down, are not going down. So I think, this topic we're on, race, racism, human variation, is such a beautiful, perfect topic for critical thinking, engaging eighth graders, ninth graders, 10th graders. Will it happen? Joe, I hope you're more optimistic than I am.
No, I'm not optimistic at all, because, and this is the reason why, and I want to be really clear on this. The forces that wish to maintain the status quo of injustice and oppression have more control over social media than those who wish to move forward with a new vision of society. And they are purposely inundating that social media with misinformation and misconceptions. And they're dressing it up in the emperor's new clothes. And it looks great, and students and the populace will, take up that falsely constructed narrative way before they will address the kinds of things that Alan and I do. Because, again, for the so-called majority of people in this country who benefit from systems of oppression and structural racism, they don't want to call into question the way they live. They don't want to stand, before a charge of saying, I must do something in the cause of justice. They don't want to hear the drum major's call. They're far more comfortable with this vacuous nonsense that parades as knowledge coming out of outlets like Fox News. And so we are at a moment in the existence of our democracy in which we are in great peril. If we are going to preserve it, if we are going to extend it, people of goodwill, and again, I'm speaking to the faith audience that's listening, going to church on Sunday and saying, poverty's bad, racism's wrong, and then going home for the rest of the week and doing absolutely nothing about it, is simply not acceptable.
Yeah, so I don't know much, to be honest, about the intersections of religion and race in the way that Joe does, and probably you do too, Reverend Walker. But I do know the history of science, and I want to say this is a particularly fraught moment, but it's not a new moment. Scientists from the very get-go, they didn't invent the idea of race, but they sure took it and ran with it. And they took it and ran with it as, separate species, separately invented, separately created, or degraded, and absolutely hierarchically ranked. And that for centuries has given everybody cover you know, by everybody, I mean, you know, white males in particular with power, to give them to say, okay, you know, I've got more money, I've got more X, I've got more Y, I've also got longer lives, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because I'm in the group that God created, or, you know, evolution created to be better than. And to dismantle that myth that Joe, for example, has been working tirelessly for, you know, 30, 35 years, give or take, you know, is such important work. And it's beginning to trickle. I mean, there's little bits of trickling of this from, you know, a scientific consensus. I mean, there is now a scientific consensus, finally, that race as a genetic concept is a myth. We are not hierarchically ranked. God didn't do it. Evolution didn't do it. But to get that scientific consensus out into publics, out, you know, into K-12, et cetera, we're just not there yet. And I say one more thing. I mean, I like to compare this to the arguments about climate change. Took climate scientists a long time to finally convince the public that global warming was a reality. It took a lot of funding. It took Yale and other institutions not just having climate think tanks, but having educational think tanks about climate to finally begin to, you know, shift the needle of public opinion. And it's finally shifted. You know, where we'll go from there, I don't know. But compare that to the idea of race, which we've known in some sense for hundreds of years is a myth. You know, we haven't begun to budge that needle, or I don't think we begin to budge it at all.
Right. I think so. One of the things I think, even as a person who is in the public square, who's preaching and teaching in churches and congregations all of the time, it does give you pause. And I do think that there's great peril in the country at the moment. But you had a line in your book that said racial inequalities and racism are not forever. So that gave me a sprout of hope. So is that indeed the case? It's not forever. And does that give us some glimmer of hope that there are ways in which we will be able to reach out to people, despite the people of the world who don't want this general information out that racism is not real, but that racism is, and how we can begin to dismantle some of these systems?
Reverend Walker, I'm sure you are familiar with what Reverend King said. The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Yes. Now, I add to that sentence because, you know, I agree with King, but it bends towards justice only if we pull really hard. Yeah. Because we have to recognize that those who support injustice are pulling hard too. And we have had moments where we have seen, you know, the mountaintop. We've seen a vision of justice and equality. We have been the better angels of ourselves.
Yeah.
But to be honest, okay, those moments are few and far in between. Most of the time, okay, we have been more in the camp of the devil and then of God. And that's where we are right now. Okay. And because, you know, I have, you know, no fear to speak what I think is the truth, and folks may disagree with me, but right now, okay, this country is empire. A lot of Christians are under the false impression that, you know, the United States, you know, should or has had a Christian mission. I completely disagree. I think this nation is empire. And if we are going to live up to our faith and to our creed, then we have to resist its evil institutions. And structural racism is amongst the most evil. Now, there's a whole bunch of other evils. And when we're seeing these things come to the forefront of the daily discourse, I mean, literally, you turn on the news, you turn, read a newspaper. It's some other evil plan raising itself up. And that's why I say that we are in great danger. We are not guaranteed to win. You know, I would like to think that, you know, God has scripted it out and in the end, we're all going to be okay. But I just don't think God works that way. I think that what will happen here depends upon what we are willing to do. And if we are not willing to stand up for justice, okay, then injustice will continue and we may lose the opportunity to ever change this society. We are perilously close to that point where change for justice may no longer exist.
And I agree with you. And I don't think in this day and age, I'm not sure you ever could preach a theology of, you know, we should sit and wait for God. I don't even think the Bible tells us that. The Bible does not teach us to sit and wait and God is just going to come by and rescue us, because there has to be a plan in place. God will give us the tools necessary, but we have to do the work. We are the hands and feet of the society. So I understand, I think, exactly what you're saying. I think the underlying question is, we have to do this work together. And I think so. The question is, do we have enough allies to help us get through, help the oppressed? When I say we, the oppressed people, be able to move that or, you know, pull on that arc so that we are bending it towards justice and towards peace and equality. And I guess from an anthropological standpoint, then I'm going to ask Alan, is it possible that we can have a society in which we can have enough of the people who have the power or the privilege, however you wish to define that, standing on the, I'll say the right side of this issue, on the right side of the arc, so that we have the power to pull, but we also have the energy to keep pulling until we get where we need to be?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I like this notion that, the moral arc bends towards justice, but it's not going to bend on its own, that we need to bend it. I think the one thing I would add to this is the word truth. Kind of in truth and reconciliation. And, we've sort of got a little bit of glimmer, for example, of a conversation about reparations going on in this country. I think we're not going to have reparations until we have truth and reconciliation, so, and this gets right back to questions around education, about critical inquiry and things of that sort, because it's not like, where there's one word truths, but there's complex truths, that we need to understand and we need to teach. So who are our allies? Maybe our allies are younger folks who hopefully will get the education like Joe is trying to give them. I've also worked with eighth graders and have found tremendous energy in eighth graders understanding about the intersections of race, racism, human variation. I think if a lot of young folk come, to really understand the harms of racism, the myths of race, et cetera, then that's where I think the moral arc will begin to bend towards justice. I'm not, on the other hand, going to wait for presidents and senators and things of that sort. But, I hope the young, that's my point of faith, is that the young will understand the truth.
If I could just add quickly to what Alan said, I think there are far more people in this society and in the world who will benefit from tearing down these structures of injustice. I mean, it's clear, right? We have a society where there is a small group of people who control the world's global economy, and the gap between the haves and have-nots is getting greater and greater and greater. And so they therefore understand that there are far more people who would benefit from changing these systems of oppression then stand to gain from them. And that's why their actions now have become so desperate and so vicious. And that's, you know, why we're you know, coming into that time of trial where we will be tried, and how we respond to this time will determine the future of our species on this planet.
One of the things that I really enjoy, too, about your book is that not only do you talk about helping us to define and understand a lot of these terms, but that also you talk about how they're impacting us as humans, right? So you talked about the mortality rates among people of color and some of the other ways in which people are desperately, the lifespan, everything is impacted because of the trauma of racism. And I just wondered, Dr. Goodman, if you could just speak for a moment on how personal and systemic racism and all of those impact the mortality rates. So that was fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'll jump a little bit forward to say that, you know, how will we know when we live in a world without racism? And I would say, you know, one measure of that would be when mortality rates are in morbidity rates, where the life expectancy of an average African-Americans, Hispanics, et cetera, are the same as European-Americans. Right now, unfortunately, the gap is widening, you know, through COVID. And the number of years lost that I think can only be attributed to systemic racism of non-whites in the United States is just simply deplorable. Today, you know, as we speak, the difference in infant mortality between the chances of dying in your first year of life, if you're a white baby versus an African-American baby, is 2.2-fold difference. The chance of an African-American woman dying due to childbirth is over three times that of a white woman. Pretty much every single disease one looks at, mortality and prevalence is greater in African-Americans than European-Americans. So, you know, that's a national tragedy. And, you know, that's why I say it's easier to talk about race than racism. And maybe it's easier to talk about racism theoretically than the consequences of racism. I think we really need to be talking about the consequences of racism. And that shows up in wealth and health. And, you know, and I've just given you a couple examples of many that we could give about differences in health.
Yes, indeed. So one of the things that you noted was that we're not post-racial. I'm not sure that will ever be a thing, but I guess if we eradicate race, we'll get rid of being or we'll stop seeking for a post-racial society. But Joe, I just wanted to see in terms of how you view post-racial, because I tied that into the information, too, about how we collect data for the census. Right. And so so how can we be post-racial, but yet we're still trying to collect information based on race? And the other part of that is then how will we going forward be able to determine whether or not we have achieved the equality that Alan just mentioned, when we know that all of our life expectancy is pretty much on an equal footing?
So, I mean, again, it starts with that term race to begin with. So when we're talking about post-racial, we're talking about socially defined racial groups,
right?
Not biological groups. And I want to keep that forefront in the conversation. And if we're talking about socially defined groups, then what we're really measuring are sociological data. In other words, these socially defined groups are experiencing American society in different ways. And that has been measured. And we continue to need to measure that. Because if we don't measure that, like, you know, Alan points out that they don't measure it in France, you know, they don't measure it in Germany, they have no way of knowing that these people are facing desperate conditions due to structural racism in those countries. So, you know, in my book, The Race Myth, that was published back in 2005, basically I said that, you know, we should wither these you know, racial categories as structural racism disappears. Mm. We'll be able to see that through the sociological data. As Alan said, when the life expectancy of an African-American child and a European-American child born in the same year are the same, then we won't need to continue to, you know, to collect data by socially defined race. But I also am going to say that, you know, in this current socioeconomic system, that can never happen, because this current socioeconomic system requires racism to operate. And so therefore, the challenge is to recognize that the way we are currently doing things gives us the results that we see. So as a scientist, you know, and trained in mathematics, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. 2 + 2 is never going to equal 5. So long as we're operating a 2 + 2 = 4 system, we're going to get the number 4. So if we want to get the number 5, we're going to have to go 2 + 3, right? That means we have to change the system. Okay. And until we change the system, these results are all we can ever expect.
I know we're just about out of time. We probably are really out of time, but I'm going to ask one final question. And that was the impact of what you all refer to as everyday racism in society. So I will give each of you a moment to just talk about those five areas, or one of the five areas in which we are impacted by everyday racism. And then, and the last part of that, as you answer that, tell me, how do we begin to tear this away? Just where do we start?
I mean, we have to insist that people be treated fairly, not based on their socially defined race. Like, and again, Reverend Walker, you know, you are faculty at North Carolina Central University. I'm a faculty member at North Carolina A&T. Our students are funded at a different level compared to students at UNC Chapel Hill and NC State. So how is this so? I mean, are our students any less valuable to the state of North Carolina? And the answer is no. I mean, our students bring a tremendous amount of contribution to this state, but it's harder for us to educate them because we are given less. And we've been historically underfunded by this state to the tune of around $1.3 billion for North Carolina A&T alone. And so that's an example of everyday racism. The fact that our students are not being given the resources that they deserve, given, you know, the fact that they are human beings too.
I guess last thing I would say is thinking about everyday racism is that about how the ideologies that get into individuals' brains through their parents, through their who they grow up with. You know, we're not born believing in race, but we quickly inherit our parents' ideas about us and them, structures of difference. That, as Joe says, intersects with materialities, what we have to, you know, our houses, our institutions to develop. And so I think there is, as Joe says, it's a structure that has to be overcome. And that's a heavy lift, but I think it's possible. I think truth does tend to win out. And, you know, one of the things I really hope is that, for example, the white working class will begin eventually to realize that it's not that they're white, they're hiding behind their whiteness is not helping them. They are poor too. They are also dying of diseases of despair, et cetera, and will begin to sort of understand that their future is not in separateness, but in coming together across class lines and especially across ethnic and racial lines.
That's great. Thank you so much. I think we've all got to have some hope because that'll give us the clarity to keep moving forward and continue the fight, right? Continue the struggle. But I want to encourage people to please go out and get the book, Racism, Not Race, Answers to Frequently Asked Questions. I thank you, Joseph Graves and Alan Goodman, for being here with us. But that is all the time we have for this episode. And I also want to always thank my producer, Christine McTaggart, and you, the listener. See you next time.
Thank you.